You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 431 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion, Storm.
I'm coming to you from Wren, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. This is an impregnable edition. This is the Cam Chancellor edition, of course.
It is another LOB edition. Certainly, yeah. I mean, Cam Chancellor, so associated with number 31 in Seattle, with all due respect to Brent Berry.
Oh, Bones.
Friend of the pod, Brent Berry.
I was thinking, Derek McKee, was he number?
He was, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there have been some little 31s out there. But Cam just like so associated with 31, with a championship, with this city. He's still out there in scratch ads with Richard Sherman, the two members of the Legion of Boom who are in the
Those
Seattle
ads
area.
Those are kind of awesome. They kind of nail it back to back years.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Cam Chancellor. Love it.
Well, football season is upon us.
Somehow I did not put either Brent Berry or Derek McKee in my spreadsheet, but did put Tina Charles for the Storm, who Tina Charles tonight against the Seattle Storm, revenge game, had her first career triple-double in the first in the history of the Atlanta Dream.
There you go.
In a losing effort.
But this is, of course, the last weekly podcast that we do before the football season starts. We'll be previewing the Husky season, I assume, at least a little bit.
A little bit. I mean, I don't know that we're going that in depth on it.
But we're going to a football game this weekend.
That is the plan, yeah. It's been a long time. I mean, much longer for me than you. I don't, because you attended Seahawks games. The last game I attended was the Apple Cup. So it was November, the last time I attended a football game.
Wow. Okay. I'm excited. I'm ready for it. I've been out there getting every fall item. I got a pumpkin spice muffin today. Or whatever. I know that you're not ready for this.
Oh, if there's absolutely not.
If there's one thing that I know about you, it's that you hate the seasonal creep and people being excited about the fall.
Fall is the worst of it because, as you know, I am not a fall person. I am a summer.
Literally
person.
The best season. I don't understand how we could be raised literally in the same house at the same time. And that you could end up not being a fall person.
Weird. I like it when it's sunny and warm all the time. I don't know.
Everything about fall is perfect.
Call me unique. Except when it rains constantly.
It doesn't really rain constantly. Spring, I am not a spring person.
But spring things are getting better. Fall things are getting worse. Fall is bad. Hashtag bad.
This is a hill that you're going to die alone on, and the fall is bad hill. Nobody else agrees with this.
I don't think I'm dying alone on this.
Football to get us through in fall. Spring, you got nothing.
The NBA playoffs?
March Madness? See, that's the thing is you care about spring sporting events, and I care about fall sporting events. It was funny. Luca got concerned about baseball season. This feels like after the podcast talk. He was concerned about the baseball season because he's starting at practice again. And I'm like, dog, you don't play a game until March at the soonest. And I'm like, we have seasons to get through. Literally.
More than a quarter of your life will take place before you play a game.
I'm like, when March Madness has started, then you can start getting nervous about baseball, but not in August. In August, goddamn it, we are not getting nervous about baseball. I was like, are you nervous that school is starting? And he's like, no, it's the parent meeting for baseball. And I'm just like, absolutely not. That is unacceptable. Call me when the dogs are in the NCAA tournament.
Oh, which ones?
There's going to be one.
What do you mean?
There'll be a dog.
Yeah.
I guarantee you.
The Huskies.
And if there isn't a, if
UConn
there
Huskies,
isn't a dog,
I like the
yeah,
chance.
Then we could pretty much just mark that one down now.
I was wondering about the Georgia dogs because I don't know if Tay's gotten into Georgia basketball yet.
Not a ton.
Sticking to football? Sticking
but
to Carson
there is
Beck.
Massive Georgia football game this weekend.
Was Did the Phillies end up getting a hit? The Astros didn't actually no hit them in the blowout win this afternoon, did they?
Did they? I didn't even know they were close to it.
And they were up 9-0 and throwing a no hitter at one point today. I don't know. That was when I was listening to the Mariners broadcast and getting
The Phillies
updates.
still did pretty good service for us this week.
Yes, cannot complain, 100%. But we'll get to that later in the podcast. The Phillies, let's see here. I guess I'm not looking
I
at
mean, I
this in
didn't
the right
hear that there
place.
was a no-hitter, so I'm sure there wasn't. I would have known if
They
there was
did
a
end up
no-hitter.
with two hits off of Arrigetti, who was no hitting them for into the eighth. So both of those came in the eighth inning, and the Astros won 10-0. Well, you know what we do in August? Let's celebrate a couple of legends.
Hello.
We're toasting to Megan Rapinoe and Sue Bird, who were both honored this weekend. Sue answered one of my questions on Monday by referring to her and Megan as a power couple,
Wow.
which is a real power couple move. I
I
agree.
actually don't think it is. In fact, having to tell people that you're a thing is a not power couple move. I'm
No,
so sorry.
it was the opposite. It went all the way back around, and it was like it's so obvious they're a power couple, even she can acknowledge they're a power couple.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
Megan Rapinoe had her number 15 jersey retired before the Reigns game against the North Carolina Courage on Sunday with me in attendance. While Sue had a stretch of Second Avenue North leading up to Climate Pledge Arena, running past the Science Center, renamed Sue Bird Court in a ceremony on
Okay.
Monday morning. Wrote a news story about this for ESPN. It is currently honorary. Next month, the council is expected to vote on it. And when they approve it, then it can become a permanent name change to Sue Bird Court. So very exciting to have both of them
Did they
in
choose
town.
court as the thing because of the pun?
I believe that was part of it. They didn't want to do Way because it intersects with Lenny Wilkins Way, which was previously renamed outside of Climate Pledge Arena. And then she was asked, what about Sue Bird Pass? And it turns out the answer is that, like, from emergency services perspective, pass has to define a specific type of
Yeah,
road that is a
that's a
pass.
little, yeah.
I hadn't even thought of the pun. That was the Sue Bird Pass, though. I feel like I let everyone down on that one. All right, well, also at that rain game on Sunday, we are toasting to rain coach Laura Harvey, who recorded her 100th career NWSL regular season win. She's the first NWSL coach to that milestone. We're toasting to Pete Carroll, who will teach a class at USC next spring, he told KJR-FM last week. Carroll also said he's advising a few teams known in the NFL, and again made it clear, as it has been ever since the day it was announced, that his advisory capacity for the Seahawks is complete BS.
Why did they do that? I don't even get it. Like, what is gained by doing that?
They didn't fire him. They didn't want to embarrass him by firing him.
Oh, how embarrassing. Did we hear what the class is about that he's teaching at USC?
And no details as yet. We'll
Okay.
know more when it is on the syllabus. So,
Like a motivation class? Like what would
I mean, I feel like Pete could definitely teach a some form of psychology class, I think, based on it. That was what his grad work was, I believe, at the University of the Pacific, if I'm correctly remembering, Wind
In
Forever from my
psychology.
last
Okay.
reading.
Pumped and jacked psychology.
There's definitely a discussion of Maslow's hierarchy of needs in Wind Forever. Like all good books.
Every book.
A test to form weirdly does not appear at any point in any of the pro basketball prospectus books. That's why they're not good.
Yeah. Poorly
Uh,
rated.
a, a toast to former Sounder Victor Rodriguez, hero of the 2019 MLS Cup win in front of home fans on his retirement. Rodriguez was the MVP of that win after scoring the second goal off the bench as the Sounders beat Toronto FC 3-1 to actually cap his 3-year stint in Seattle. That was his final game for the Sounders. The Spanish native finished his career playing the last two seasons in the India Super League. All
Fair
right.
enough.
And then
And
last.
have you been paying attention to the India Super
Yeah,
League for those two seasons? Now, I want to
I
mention
don't know who the
the thing
power
about
is.
Pete Carroll, though, is I thought it was interesting that it was at USC, obviously, as a son who's coaching at UW, presumably lived in Seattle at least for some of this, had two houses. Pete Carroll is a USC legend. If you have one coaching job that even though he won a Super Bowl in Seattle and was maybe the second best coach in the NFL for the last decade, Pete Carroll is USC legend. Pete Carroll, that is front and center of who he is. And seeing that he went back there was kind of like,
I don't wish to imply that Pete Carroll is ever going to die, but that the USC coach leads his obituary. I guess it's, you know, the two NCAA championships and a Super Bowl and the limited number of coaches who have won at both levels. But USC coach is definitely.
But I really think if you chose, and especially with some distance from it, I think if you look back and say, what is the one defining job for Pete Carroll's career? It is USC. Which is kind of strange that he came here and coached for, you know, a decade plus and won a Super Bowl in Seattle, and still USC is the defining job of his coaching career.
I mean, he coached way longer with the Seahawks than he did at USC, right? Was he even for a decade at
USC?
Was
there 04 was his first year?
I couldn't figure this out because one of the things that's been interesting about this season of Hard Knocks, which you continue to refuse to watch.
I haven't seen it, yeah.
How many hours of flights did you have this last week?
you don't even want to know what I watched. I chose to watch Madam Web. That elicited that response from you.
Over
you
Roman
know what?
Dunze.
I loved every second of watching Madam Web. Every once in a while.
In an ironic sense?
Not even in an ironic sense. Like,
wow.
I feel like I don't watch bad movies ironically. I watch bad movies just to be like, I'm just a thing is happening. You know what I mean? Like, I liked watching it in the way that I like watching Batman and Robin.
What's the name of the movie that is the worst movie we've ever seen? I don't know if you think it's the worst movie we've ever seen, but we watched it together.
Oh, you're talking about Congo?
Yeah, and it is undoubtedly far and away. I don't know what the rankings are. I really hated the movie Bringing Down the House. Or whatever they called the movie, 21, I don't know.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Queen Latifah and Steve Martin movie. Isn't that called Bringing Down the House?
It might be. I don't know the names of these things.
Yeah, 21, I think, was that movie, though, right?
The book, I believe, is called Bringing Down the House, about the MIT blackjack team. That was an awful movie. It was still so much better than Congo. Like, it was the most amateur.
I think we were children and we just couldn't. I think Congo has eventually become a bit of a cult classic. In a lot of ways, like a camp classic, but that 21 movie that you're talking about, incredible sync for MGMT.
I know, I do. That was like
that
the only part of it I remember.
If you told me, like, what do you remember about this movie? Boom, MGMT. That's it.
100%. No,
and
notes.
You know what? Saltburn doesn't happen without it. So
okay, fair point. Fair point. Although mixed reviews on Saltburn, I think I'm on pro side there.
There are mixed reviews on Saltburn. People just weren't ready for Saltburn.
So you watched Madam Web over Hard Knocks. This is what led us here. What were you saying?
I loved it. it was pretty bad, but I watched half because the flight from New York to Cleveland's like an hour, right? So I watched half. And then you know what? I looked forward to watching the second half. Cleveland to Seattle, I watched the second half. I was just like, we've got to see what's going on here.
Oh boy, just counting down the minutes until I can get on the old Alaska Wi-Fi and fire up Madam Web. Anyways.
I need the Alaska Wi-Fi. I had it downloaded on Netflix. I could have watched it anywhere, anytime.
Oh, good. Anyways. Pete Carroll coached 9 seasons at USC.
Adam Scott, also, you can't deny, any time he's around. Uncle Ben, I guess.
That's fair.
I didn't put any of the like Spider-Man pieces together. And then I went and read the Wikipedia about Madam Web.
That's a cry for help.
It was kind of funny though, because I was listening to the podcast about the Sony leak that the Ringer is doing. And Sony famously are the ones who have the rights. That's the Sony Spider-Man universe that Madam Web is part of. And it was kind of interesting just like listening to those two in concert with each other.
Just like MGM was in concert with the movie 21.
MGMT.
Yes, MGM. I don't know if MGM produced 21. I'm unclear who did. Pete Carroll coached 9 seasons at USC. 14 for the Seahawks.
They were a legendary 9. I'm telling you, they were the most important 9 seasons of his career.
I'm not disputing it. I'm just noting it. Hard Knocks So the Bears are on there, and their offensive staff is largely the Seahawks 2023 offensive coaching staff. Shane Waldron, Kerry Joseph is quarterback coach. Chad Morton, who's been getting a lot of screen time, is running back coach.
Really?
So it's
Old
kind of
USC
the
running back, Chad Morton, huh?
who did not, this is one of the reasons I was thinking about this with Pete Carroll, did not overlap with Pete Carroll. He finished his career in 2000. So
Really?
his connection with Pete Carroll came well after the fact.
I mean, he
But so
probably
it's
built a relationship with former USC players also.
probably, but I can't remember where. I think he came, he came from the Packers. So I think it actually may have been like some John Schneider Packers ties potentially, as opposed
Interesting.
to Carroll USC ties necessarily.
Kerry Joseph is the safety, right?
Yes, who now
It's
coaches quarterbacks.
the same Kerry Joseph, though.
Correct.
So strange.
So it's been a bit of a window into the Seahawks coaching staff because the Seahawks have never been in Hard Knocks, and it's kind of fun. Like Shane Waldron is very low key, but Chad Morton is the camera loves him. He's working
What
with
what
Jennifer
have you
King. There is their assistant running back coach. A lot of focus on the two of them, and then like two of the main players they've highlighted during camp have been running backs.
What is the insight that you've gotten into the Seahawks coaching staff?
I mean, I don't think it's been anything surprising in terms of, just the relentless energy and that sort of thing that they coach with. But it's just been interesting to, see a little bit more behind the scenes.
Okay.
And also
Same with
Romo
Matt.
doing
Same with Madam Web. When they release the
things.
extended cut, we'll see more behind the scenes also. BTS.
The director's cut, the Snyder cut. Lastly, we are toasting to UW Men's Soccer, which took down number 4 Oregon State 1-0
Oh, hello.
on Monday at Husky Soccer Stadium in what is now a non-conference matchup. That's the thing. They had previously lost 2-1 at number 22 Portland in their season opener, but a big win for the UW Men's
Wow.
Soccer program as they
State of
head
Oregon.
into Big Ten play. Yes, they will not exclusively be playing teams from the state of Oregon. At some point, they will be moving on.
I'm also just impressed with the rankings of the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
I got on with an artist earlier this week, and they hadn't seen that I had a mustache, and he was like, that mustache looks like you're from Portland. And then he was like, I hate that place so much. Talked about how much he hated Portland, and I was like, give me more. I was like, feed me.
Except when you like Portland.
My favorite part, I was like, you just said that I look like I'm from Portland, and then talked about how much you hated Portland.
That is a great play. I love it.
But he was like, no, it looks good.
I'm assuming it wasn't Aramis.
No.
Okay, because he has been known to sport a similar mustache in his day. But I could see him hating Portland, and I would enjoy him talking trash about Portland if so.
I don't know his feelings. I think his feelings on Portland are generally positive.
But he does not like the Taco Times there. We do know that from his
No one
Taco
does.
Time appearance.
No one does.
So we do not have a search for Seattle's best cookie today. I attempted to pick up cookies with Tiffany. I efforted it at the Wallingford Street Fair or Wallingford Market or whatever they call it today, which was a lovely time. A lot of people out walking around in Wallingford. It made me nostalgic for
Don't you people
my
have jobs?
6 months. I spent, well, it was at 6 p.m.
Okay,
It made me
fine.
nostalgic for the 6 months that I spent living in Wallingford with the famous Cousin Katie.
In the U District.
And so I was going there because Cookies with Tiffany said that they were there. It turns out they no longer are at the Wallingford Farmers Market. But the helpful person at the information desk who told me this did tell me that Zilberstein's had cookies there. And they had been mentioned, their cookies had been mentioned on the Discord. So I wanted to try those. And I picked up a couple of those, but they didn't have the full set. So, and then one of the cookies I bought turned out to have nuts. It was not advertised to me as having nuts, but it did. So I didn't think this was worth like you reviewing right now, but I do think we are eventually going to have to get there to try them out, is
Okay.
my analysis. So that's my update. But I had, let me see here. I had the cornflake marshmallow cookie,
Okay.
as well as the Burt
Sounds pretty
Gilman
good.
cookie, an oatmeal
Burke
cookie made with
Gilman cookie.
cashews, cranberries, and honey. So I thought the
Okay.
cornflake marshmallow cookie was better, but they also have a chocolate chip and a black and white. So curious to try those.
Okay.
You tried some cookies though on your trip when
Yes,
you
New
weren't
York
watching
City
Madame Web.
cookies. Anyway, so I put down Madame Web for a second. I was like, I'll have to return to you in a moment. Because when you're in Brooklyn, you have to watch cinema. Anyway, I had a couple of different cookies in New York while I was there. I went to a bakery called Thea Bakery. It's a brand new location from, there's a chef named, what is his name? Tomer Blechman, Blemen, who has a Michelin star. It's a restaurant called Miss Ada, and just opened up this bakery, Thea, which was excellent across the board. And they had a cookie that was a like tahini, I believe it was
Oh,
tahini.
they
It's sort of
also have a tahini
Mediterranean inspired.
one at Silverstein's
Okay.
that was not available again at the market. So
So it's like salted chocolate chip tahini. And it was kind of one of those situations where I was just like going through everything, and then I saw the cookie and I'm like, yes, and the cookie also, because there was a good looking cookie and I have to do it, you know, for the
yeah.
content. That cookie was honestly like, it was pretty warm outside, sat in the sun, so the chocolate chips were gooey. It was pretty phenomenal, I have to say. For a bakery cookie, it's not exactly their specialty or whatever, but that was the best cookie that I had in New York. And I also went to a location called the Good Batch Bakery, which I believe also, you know, they have a brick and mortar store. I think only one in Brooklyn area. And then they're also part of like a street fair that happens, and got like six different types of cookies that reminded me a little bit more of like a Hello Robin type location. I thought they were fine. There was nothing that really stood out to them though, or would make me think like, yes, this would be a competitor were it in Seattle for Seattle's best cookie.
They also have a tahini, huh?
I
Tahini
mean,
chocolate chunk.
that at the Good Batch,
Yeah.
tahini's in.
Tahini is in. Let's do it. One of the ones from the location did on Portage Bay had tahini, right? Or they just had sesame seeds. Maybe they
Same
didn't have
bread.
tahini. Yeah.
That one was incredible. I
I
still
agree.
actually, I've, you just say that and I'm like taken to a place. Man, that cookie was good.
Well, there's some more good cookies we have to get to, but alas, no full review of any Seattle cookies this
Katie brought
week.
up Saint Bread to me today and I was like, that's like good
What?
shit.
You don't think I know about that? One other bit of food news that's
I pray to them every day, Saint Bread.
yes, we know your theology is Saint Bread. A troubling food update. Former Ado chef Eric Rivera, who was a guest on our chef series, was arrested on domestic violence charges last week in South Carolina. Eater had a report on this, so you know we're certainly thinking of the victim here, and you know, troubling to hear. All right, with that, it is time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, every team, every season needs a name. They're the refuse to lose Mariners. You gotta love these guys, Mariners. The fun differential Mariners. The don't look now Mariners of a year ago. And thanks to a few swift coaching changes, we now have our 2024 name, because this is the dream of the 90s Mariners. Remember in the 90s when the Mariners played scrappy baseball, stealing bases, manufacturing runs, putting pressure on the opposing pitching staff? The dream of the 90s is alive in Seattle. Remember in the 90s when the Mariners came up with timely hits from unlikely players, pesky left-handers like Doug Strange and Luke Raley now helped them with huge comebacks? The dream of the 90s is alive in Seattle. Remember in the 90s when they had the coolest outfield in the entire league, three fun players who made exciting plays defensively, hit for power, and interacted with the fans around them? The dream of the 90s is alive in Seattle. Remember in the 90s when Dan Wilson and Edgar Martinez were on the team? The dream of the 90s is alive in Seattle. And remember in the 90s when the team made a huge run to close the gap on the playoffs, lose any chance of the wild card, but hone in on the division, eventually having one of the greatest comebacks in club history, leading to playoff series win? Well, don't write them off just yet here, folks. because with this team, the dream of the 90s is alive in Seattle.
So the Mariners fired Scott Service since we last recorded a podcast.
Hello.
They did that on Thursday in between their series against the Dodgers and returning home to face Tampa Bay. No, Tampa Bay was this past weekend. Who'd they face before then?
The Giants?
The Giants, yes. Scott Service found out about this on television because it was reported by Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic. You missed this news story entirely, this news cycle?
Yes.
When you get surprised by news.
I found out about it via push notification, or no, not via push notification, via Twitter, I think. And then hours later, so they must have basically made the decision internally, not informed Scott Service yet, but that news leaked.
Yeah, Scott Service was meeting with Jerry DePoto and presumably some other members of Mariners management later in the day after this got reported. And that's when they were hoping to share the news with him. I mean, given the partnership between Service and DePoto, the former teammates in MLB, DePoto hired Service, was his handpicked manager when he came to the Mariners.
I did not know that Jerry DePoto was a major league player. Had no idea.
You didn't?
No, this is the first time learning of it.
I guarantee you, I don't know what Jerry DePoto has hair. We were doing the podcast at that point. I guarantee you I mentioned it back then. You probably weren't paying attention because at that point the Mariners were the roundup.
They weren't even in the roundup. They were just like non-existent.
I'm sure we talked about when they hired Jerry DePoto. Maybe we talked about it offline, depending on when that actually happened. This is not a good way to do business. So it sucks. But and so Dan Wilson is not the interim manager. He is just the manager going forward, which I think was a bit surprising.
I agree that it sucks and that communication matters, but ultimately it's kind of similar to the Pete Carroll thing where the outcome is what really matters here. Like Scott Service was fired. No matter how he found out about it, you know, the news is what it is.
It's not like he's gonna be like, well, yeah, they fired me, but at least I found out about it first. Yes. I agree with that.
I was a little surprised. Obvious times were bleak for the Mariners after the sweep against the Dodgers. It was one of those situations where it felt like, you know, this season was over and it felt like the franchise was in a bit of a tailspin. So I at the same time, given how long Scott Service had been the manager of the Mariners, and that he has led probably during this kind of 4-year run, the best time period that the Mariners have had since the early 2000s. At the same time, none of it is that impressive. Like, this is not to minimize any of the achievements that Scott Service has had. Making the playoffs as manager of the Mariners is still a good thing, but it's not like they fired, like Pete Carroll won a Super Bowl and played in another Super Bowl for the Seahawks. It is a different thing that somebody like Pete Carroll achieved as head coach of the Seattle Seahawks. Scott Service as manager of the Mariners.
Equating those. I mean,
I'm just saying, like, I don't know if it's one of those situations where it's like he's not a manager who can be fired midseason. I think Scott Service was a manager who could be fired midseason, and he was ultimately.
I mean, it's more like, actually, as we've talked about, changing managers midseason, aside from 90s vibes, and a surprising emphasis on the running game, as you mentioned, which I guess makes sense with Dan Wilson being a former catcher, although Scott Service was also a former catcher. But
they all are.
Again, Scott Service. Too into analytics. Exclusive must credit to Pelton Cast. Yeah, I mean, like, look, the good thing about Dan Wilson in this position is the Mariners.
Was a pitcher. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he was a reliever.
They had the whole battery, huh?
They were a battery, yes. Dan Wilson is in a fortunate position to take advantage of the Mariners regressing to the mean and also getting somewhat healthier. Like Julio Rodriguez today hit home run, his first since coming off the IL. JP Crawford is back now, made his return in Wednesday afternoon's game. So, and the Mariners just probably aren't going to keep hitting as poorly as they were beforehand, especially in this stretch of this bleak road trip that eventually costs Scott Service his job. Like, if you want to be a popular and considered a good coach, the strategy is to exclusively take over teams that have underperformed their talent and then get the credit when things inevitably regress to the mean.
But the thing is, if we're under the assumption that managers don't matter all that much, you might as well hire somebody that people like. And
I suppose that's
Dan Wilson
fair.
is somebody that
People, but
people like.
people, to be clear, did like Scott Service a
I
great
think
deal.
people generally like Scott Service, but the team has been very frustrating these last two seasons. And that's kind of undeniable. Whether it's Jerry DePoto's fault or Scott Service's fault,
What do you mean, whether it's that like makes it sound like it's a question?
you're saying it's completely Jerry DePoto?
I don't think that
This,
managers have almost any influence on teams' record whatsoever.
I think Scott Service, people were frustrated with Scott Service overall.
Yeah, people were frustrated because he's the visible face of the team. If Jerry DePoto sat in the dugout every day and made decisions that were like 100 decision, multiple decisions per game that were easy to second guess, people would be more frustrated with him. Also, I think people are more frustrated with John Stanton than either of those two.
Yeah, sure, I agree.
But you can't
But
fire him.
I think it was time to make this change. We could see immediately the difference of how different Dan Wilson is going to be, for better or worse. Dan Wilson is not a new school manager. With your talking at the emphasis on stolen bases, looking at it, I believe they've had 10 stolen bases in the six games that Dan Wilson has coached. They were averaging 0.1 stolen base per game before then. They would be top in the league
I
if
mean,
they
stolen
continued
bases
that.
are back in to a degree analytically, right?
I mean, with the new pickoff rules, like I think they've only been caught stealing twice in that time period.
Julio
I
got
think,
thrown out to today, right?
yeah,
Not a
Julio
hit
was
and
thrown out.
run.
That's one of them, and I think Dylan Moore got caught
Not
stealing.
a hit and run. But it was two strikes. Yeah.
But you did see it in the game. I mean, I thought they were going to win this game in the game Tuesday night when it was 0-0. Robles steals third. They throw the ball to the outfield, and then he scores. It's like there is a value to stealing bases and putting pressure on the pitching staff, especially because you just can't throw over as many times as you could.
I mean, I don't
Stealing
think I
is
would have.
easier now than it was before.
I don't want to position Scott Service as like anti-steals. He oversaw the Chaos Ball team of 2022. That team had a very different roster than this year's roster, which is long on is much slower and more strikeout prone. They're three true outcome ball.
There's also been a lot of bunting in the Dan Wilson era.
that I think is a more legitimate Scott Service was
But also,
against
it
this.
kind of worked. I was a little frustrated about it, and they like advanced the runner. And then I can't remember which, maybe this is Sunday's game. They like bunted, advanced the runner, and then had a hit, and then the runner scored. And I was like, well, all right.
Like, you know who has stolen the most bases in the AL by far?
Who's that?
Tampa Bay, who's a very analytical team. So, again, I think they're in. Mariners are fifth in the AL in stolen bases entering today. Not all under
I mean,
Dan
there are good
Wilson.
teams who steal bases. It's
Yeah.
kind of pretty evenly distributed across the board, whether you do or not. But also, they're a pretty fast team.
But that's
So,
what I'm saying is I think a lot of it is, well, they traded for Randy Arozarena a couple of weeks ago. He has to actually get on base to have a chance to steal, but he's done that more during this homestand, thankfully.
and they re-sign. They're playing Victor Robles to re-sign Robles.
Julio is healthy.
Julio, Robles, Crawford, Dylan Moore, like these players can steal bases. So fuck it. I mean, Luke Raley, at the very least, they are
It's
trying
not.
something.
It's not like, hey, why are you know? It's not like he's giving Mitch Haniger and Mitch Garver the green light. Is my point.
They needed, the Mariners needed to try something different than what they were doing. And with this offense, the way it is, you know, obviously today you had homers from all three of the outfielders, which is incredible
What a
stuff.
sentence.
Having the out the Arozarena Julio Robles outfield is just like sign me up for that, and then all three of them homering. I hope it's not the last time that happens, but that's going to happen. The steals aren't going to be the entire offense, but there are days that the Mariners have a very difficult time scoring runs, and if you they have to figure out a way to try to get some more runs, whether it's, you know, you could argue the caught stealing or whatever, but if there's a way, like Victor Robles did on Tuesday night, steal third, force the error, score on that play, like that's more than they got sometimes under the Scott Service regime. So they also just had to try something different. I mean, literally it was a hot take, but like the opposite of what they were doing was probably the right thing.
I mean, I don't know. I think overreacting and firing the managers actually was what they were doing for a long period of time. The one surprising note I found when we asked about this on the Discord, the last time the Mariners and Seahawks changed coaches in the same year was 2009, I believe. And it only had happened, or it happened a couple of times recently.
Was that when Scott Service was hired? It was Scott Service and Pete
Carroll. Service was 2015. Let me go redo my own note here. Okay, so it was 2011, but it hadn't happened until 2009, even though the Mariners were like constantly firing managers for decades and decades.
Were they, though? I mean,
other than the Lou Piniella era.
Yeah, Lou was the manager for quite a while, right?
I mean, they had their first above 500 season in franchise history and fired the manager. So that's the way they were operating for a long period of time. The Mariners made a lot of coaching changes.
Who was that manager again?
Bill Plummer.
Bill Plummer. Okay.
So in both 2009 and 2011, they both had new coaches. So they both have new coaches. Both UW men's basketball and football have new coaches, and the Kraken have a new coach.
Kind of incredible.
It's going to be a busy year for the top stories in Seattle sports unless we consolidate those all into one.
Coaching, hiring, and firing.
Which Pete Carroll probably deserves his own. When JP, so the Mariners have won 4 of 6. They've won both series since Dan Wilson took over. Still hasn't made a huge dent in their playoff odds. They're at 18% right now per Fangraphs. 3.5 back of the Astros.
The Astros do have, they have a weekend series with the Royals.
Yes. And the Mariners play the Angels this weekend. So there's a chance that they could come out of this, you know, a game back, realistically.
I that was the most frustrating part about losing the game Tuesday was the Astros had lost already, which means you're not going to lose a game, but they had a real chance to make up ground. And again, I'm still holding out hope right now.
We're in the still holding up hope phase of the season.
Wait, okay. So is that a 4-game set? Yeah,
it is a 4-game series. Yes.
I mean, the most likely outcome is probably they split that series, but if somehow the Royals could take 3 of 4, it is on the road. Royals playing very, very well right now and one of the best teams in the AL. So it's been a difficult go for the Astros. Things get a little bit easier after this. But this is kind of the window.
Oh, yeah. To make room for J.P. Crawford, Dom Canzone was sent down. Kind of a curious decision that they, even though he's not playing particularly well, but the fact that they would use an option year on him when the rosters are about to expand in 3 games. And the expectation from what I've seen, it seems to be that they'll bring up Ryan Bliss. Like they could have sent down Rivas and probably gone for a couple of days with, you know, Dylan Moore as your backup shortstop behind JP Crawford now that he's back, and then just called up Bliss. And then, you know, figured out him and Rivas down the road.
They even finished with 3 against Cleveland, too. I'm just looking at the Astros schedule.
Even if they want to bring back Canzone when rosters expand, he has to spend 10 days in the minor leagues.
Would Rivas have had to also?
Yes. But I'm saying that you would have been replacing him with an infielder if you call up Bliss either way. And then Rivas has already used his option year. He's already been up and down to the minor leagues, whereas Canzone was not. But we'll see how important that it ends up. Canzone has not hit particularly well since he's come off the injured list. Anything else on the Astros schedule?
There are a couple windows. You know, obviously, you look at the end of September, the 3-game series against the Astros. You basically just hope in that series. It's in Houston. The hope is that the Mariners are close enough in that series at the beginning of that series that they could hypothetically end it tied, even if they have to sweep. That to me would be the goal, is that they are three or less down in the division going to that series. To me, the wild card is gone. That's not an option anymore. But the Astros are still there, and you kind of have to assume the Astros are going to win something like two-thirds of their games. So the Mariners need to start winning some of these games, I guess, is the main takeaway.
Continue.
And there are a couple. A winning series is probably not going to be enough. It's a good start because they hadn't for a while. And if they, you know, retroactively speaking, if they'd even taken a game from the Dodgers or won a series against the Tigers, then they'd be in a better position. But
speaking of the why they're done in the wild card, they are tied with the Tigers in the standings.
Wow.
They have identical records now.
I mean, also seeing them around the Rays, like they're lucky overall because those teams are not competing for playoff spots. The Tigers and the Rays. They're lucky because of the division that they're in, that there's even a prayer to make the playoffs, but they've been on the opposite side of that as well. And they are in that position right now. So 3.5 games with as many games as are left and a relatively easy schedule from this point. I'm actually surprised the playoff odds aren't slightly higher.
I did think they were going to be closer to like 1-4. All right, let's get into the roundup, starting with some Kraken news. As they signed Matty Beniers to a new 7-year, $50 million contract as a restricted free agent. Beniers hit free agency at age 21. He'll turn 22 in the fall. The Calder Trophy winner is Rookie of the Year in 2022-23 with 24 goals and 33 assists. Beniers saw that drop off to 15 goals and 22 assists in his second full NHL season, seeing his shooting percentage fall from 16% to 11%. So Kraken hoping that trend's in the right direction. Obviously, age on his side to make this a very strong long-term contract. Seattle Sounders. Well, once again, LAFC managed to knock the Sounders out of a competition, this time the U.S. Open Cup. But it was not in as lopsided fashion as we saw in the League's Cup quarterfinals a few weeks ago. A tournament that LAFC went on to lose in the final to Columbus Crew. They will again be playing for a trophy in the U.S. Open Cup. It was a competitive matchup at Starfire Stadium, scoreless well into this before the Sounders got called for a handball in the box. A tough call, but it looked like ultimately the correct call from the replays that I saw. And Denis Bouanga converted the penalty to give LAFC a 1-0 lead. I didn't quite from what I was seeing understand the controversy over Jordan Morris's potential goal in the late stages and stoppage time that could have tied this one. But Sounders competitive with LAFC, but lose to them once again. In MLS regular season play over the weekend, it was a much better result. They got a feel-good 3 points on the road in Minnesota last Saturday, their first MLS matchup since before League's Cup. Jordan Morris opened the scoring in the 11th minute. Jackson Reagan scored in the 28th minute. Loons did equalize both times, but the Sounders eventually got the winner on an Albert Rushnak screamer in the 75th minute to win this one 3-2. They are up to fifth in the Western Conference standings, albeit behind Vancouver in points per match because the Whitecaps have two in hand. They are 7 points clear of the playoff cut line and 3 points up on the team from hated Portland, the Timbers, ahead of Saturday's matchup down south. They won 2-1 at Providence Park earlier this season, their first win over the Timbers since August 2021. Portland comes into this one number two in the MLS in goals scored, but has allowed the eighth most goals. Their matches have featured a total of 32 more goals between both teams in an identical number of games to the ones involving the more defensive-minded Sounders.
At least they're having fun out there.
They are playing very eventful matches in Portland. Seattle Reign FC, we talked about this in the top in the toasts. They earned their first win in NWSL play since May 3rd. Snapping a 9-game winless streak that included 4 losses and 5 draws, including 4 consecutive draws heading into the Olympic break. Besides for a big crowd turning out to honor Megan Rapinoe, we also got to see the Reign debut for Anna Maria Cernogorcevic as a starter, and then Narelia Mondesir and Jalen Howell coming off the bench. And This looked like a much more potent offensive group than the one we'd seen for the Reign in the first half of the season after Rose Lavelle's departure and Megan Rapinoe's retirement. And there's definitely a point in this where it was like, like there's a number of players who can create advantages offensively, and that just wasn't really, it felt like, the case for the Reign in the first half of the season, where they did create some opportunities and struggled to finish them. Serna Gorcevic, her work rate was really impressive in person, created a number of opportunities. And then once Jalen Howell came in, it became clear that she is my absolute favorite type of player, a box-to-box midfielder who can, win a number of tackles, but also is skilled enough, had a shot off the crossbar in her stint off the bench, and then also put one just over the top of the goal, whipping one in this one. So I'm excited to see Jalen Howell. It was disappointing to lose Bethany Balser, but feeling better about the trade, I think, after seeing Howell in person.
Okay.
So the Reign dominated possession in the second half, but they couldn't find the net and looked headed for a goalless draw before 18-year-old Emery Adames, who posted a photo from about a decade ago of her as a child with Megan Rapinoe before the match on Instagram, just truly incredible content, sent a header in that went off the post, was mishandled by Courage keeper Casey Murphy for what was technically an own goal, but certainly celebrated in the stadium is a goal for Adames, who went to the corner flag and hit Megan Rapinoe's iconic celebration pose. It was just a terrific moment to cap what was a very fun night, starting with the jersey retirement ceremony pregame. They had an all-female team of, I don't know what the technical term is here is, but parachutists who came in before the match. That was pretty awesome to see. It was a lot of fun being out at this Reign match. The weather held and it was nice.
All right.
So this weekend, Howell was headed back to face her former team, Louisville. It'll also be a reunion for the Reign against Bethany Balser this weekend. Going to be interesting for these two teams to play so quickly after the trade. All right. Well, speaking of feel good, the Seattle Storm badly needed a win on Wednesday after losing at home on Monday to the Washington Mystics, a team that is likely headed to the lottery, although they're suddenly back in the playoff race with a bit of a post-Olympic break surge. Skylar Diggins-Smith was emotional, profane with the media in her disappointment with how the team came out, and Washington was able to start that game with a big lead after the Storm had had a 5-day break. I guess it buried the lead, which is, hey, the Storm signed Gabby Williams since we last recorded a podcast. We sort of anticipated this might be happening, but it is official, and she debuted for the Storm against the Mystics. Got the start on Wednesday night against Atlanta with Jordan Horston unavailable due to illness. So a lot of excitement going into that first Storm home game since the Olympic break, and then kind of a really big letdown with how they came out and with how they eventually lost that game. Wednesday against Atlanta, the start was totally different. Jewel Loyd hit a couple of threes early. Nneka Ogumike hit one, held a double-digit lead early, but Atlanta worked their way back in the second quarter. And then down the stretch, it looked like they were going to win this one. They went up four, with, I believe, 1:40 left in the game. Storm finished it on an 8-0 run, got a 3-point play from Nneka to pull back within one. And then under 30 seconds left, trailing, they use a reset to advance the ball and call it play. And Jewel Loyd comes off a Nneka Ogumike's screen to hit the go-ahead 3-pointer. Gabby Williams then pays it off defensively with an incredibly athletic steal of an inbounds pass. Storm make their free throws, finish on an 8-0 run, and get a win they needed. So that now keeps the Storm a game ahead of the Las Vegas Aces in the standings, just as the Storm have come out slow after the Olympic break, after having a number of players involved in France. So has Las Vegas, which had four players on the U.S. team, plus Megan Gustafson also participating. I can't remember off the top of my head if they had anyone else. And despite having an opportunity to move ahead of the Storm, Las Vegas now a game back in the standings in that all-important battle for the fourth and final home court advantage spot in the Western, in the WNBA playoffs.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I wanted to ask. I mean, there's a handful of games left in the WNBA regular season. right now, when you look at it, point differential
10 games
wise,
left for both of those teams.
Record wise, you would say that the Storm are in a pretty solid position. But then looking at the future schedule, knowing that they play the next four, two against the Liberty, two against the Sun, there's a chance they lose all four of those games.
Very plausible.
And then another playoff team after that, they play the Mercury. So, I mean, that's the next half of the upcoming schedule is against teams who are going to be in the playoffs. And then six out of the 10 remaining games are against playoff teams, including those teams who are ahead of them. There are only three of them, but teams that are ahead of them in the playoffs right now. There's not parity across the WNBA at the moment. You know, when you look at the
I mean, actually, it feels a little bit that way after the Olympic break, because one of the things that's happened is Washington is one of these teams, Atlanta too, although the Storm managed to beat them today. And then Indiana and Dallas. Dallas was the team that beat Las Vegas on Tuesday night to keep the Storm ahead of them in the standings. So there, and then Los Angeles, which has been the league's worst team, took down New York on Wednesday night in a shocking result. So it does feel like there's a lot more parity out of this Olympic break.
Things have been shaken up a little bit, but
some of these teams got healthy.
Okay.
But you'd still rather face them than face New York and Connecticut. I would agree. It's not only your next four against them, they host the Liberty and Breanna Stewart on Friday night. And then the next three of those are a road trip a back-to-back set in Connecticut and then at New York. So that's going to be a tough one.
They basically need to find their way to 500 in those four games, you know, because the Aces are right there, obviously. And to stay in the fourth seed is going to be pretty difficult overall. At the same time, you have to say that throughout the season, the Storm have a legit chance in the Western Conference. I know the Lynx have been playing very, very well lately. I think they've won seven in a row, but
well, in conferences don't matter in the WNBA.
It's all
one table
once they get there. So if they're the four seed, they have to play the one seed.
Correct.
Eventually to make it to the finals.
And they make it to the finals, I don't think is a particularly realistic outcome for the Storm right now.
There's almost no chance of catching the Sun at this point.
It's pretty unlikely. I mean, you have to sweep those two games against them, I think, to have a chance to catch them. And Vegas' schedule is pretty friendly the rest of the way. They have Connecticut twice and New York once, but those are their only game. I'm looking at the two Indiana games as easier, but the Fever have also been surging lately. Not a team necessarily you want to play right now.
I think it's an interesting position that the Storm are in right now.
But I think much like you're saying about the Mariners and that they want to get to that series against the Astros with a chance, the Storm want to get to the game against Las Vegas on September 17th, the second to last game of the season for both teams, in position where, you know, they would tie the season series if they win that one at home. And, you know, it's a two-game swing in the standings. I don't think you want to just be in position that, like, you're not eliminated by that point, because the Aces finish with Dallas and they'll probably at home and they'll probably win that one. But if you're in a situation where you're tied going into that one, like, or, you know, down a game and have a chance to actually claim the tiebreaker and win a tie, then you're feeling pretty good about the situation.
Both of the games against the Sun are on the road, though.
Yep.
I think this might be insurmountable.
Not insurmountable.
To get to the three seed.
Oh, to get to the three seed? Yes. Yeah,
that's basically what I'm saying. Unlikely. Getting to the four seed, but I'm a little bit like, yes, hosting.
I don't want to think
of the season as just, which I, you know, eventually they're going to have to play the Liberty.
Also, it's not like you're going to fall down to six. So
one way or another, you have to play the Liberty. So I don't know, maybe you want to play them earlier, but I kind of feel like getting to the three seed, to me, nobody else is that scary.
So the BBI projections will not be updated until tomorrow. The Storm had a 5% chance of getting into the top three entering tonight's game.
I mean, it's those Sun games are going to have a massive swing on that, though.
Now, Connecticut did lose tonight. They lost to Indiana, so chances went up surely a little bit.
But you look at it point differential-wise, what's the difference between them? It's not significant, really, between there are slight, I guess it's about a point between 2, 3, 4 into 5, right? The Liberty are much better than all these teams, though.
Yes.
I don't see the those other teams as unbeatable in the playoffs. I think the Lynx are kind of outperforming their ability at least slightly right now.
A little.
So
I mean, the fact that they continue to play so well, they added Maisha Hines-Allen at the trade deadline. That was a nice little pickup for them.
But at some point, there might be some regression there. I guess it really just comes down to, can they win one of those two games? You know, but I don't think the Storm season, let's say that they're the fourth seed, let's say that they run in the Liberty at some point and lose. That's still a fine season that they've had. I think there is the chance of doing a little bit more here, though. And I guess from what you're saying about the second half of the season, there has been pretty significant parity.
Yeah, it's shaking things up a little bit. I mean, even tonight with the Liberty losing to the Sparks makes me feel, you know, differently about things than if we had recorded this last night.
Okay. Well, I think the Storm are in a pretty solid position then. If they're the five seed, what do they have to do at that point?
So then you'd have to, I mean, if you're the four or five, like a matchup with Las Vegas is very likely. But the way the WNBA format is, the four seed would host the first two games of that. And the five seed would have to win one on the road to get it back home for the deciding game three.
So it basically is, right now, the most likely outcome is it's going to be Storm Aces in the first round.
Correct.
I mean,
it's just a matter of whether that series starts in Seattle or Las Vegas.
The Mercury probably aren't catching either of those two teams. And the Storm
Mercury
and the Aces probably
tonight,
aren't catching the Sun.
Yeah.
So really what we're playing the rest of the season for, realistically speaking, barring something unforeseen.
Mercury need to hold off Indiana. All of a sudden, yeah, there's only a half game back in the standings.
They're playing for home court against the Sun, or against the Aces at the moment.
Yep.
And then if you win that, you have the privilege of playing Liberty.
Yep.
Is that a longer series, though?
That's a best of five, yes.
Okay, so you actually, at the very least, you guarantee, you know, a couple of, or a home game.
Correct. All right, we talked about this at the top. It is game week. The college football season is upon us. Florida State has suffered an embarrassing loss. The college football season,
love to see it,
is upon us. Busy. They're too good for the conference that they are.
I
like
really
500
feel like
against.
Florida State has kind of become like the number one villain across college football.
They're an easy punching bag, I would say. So the Huskies open the Jed Fish era Saturday night against Weber State. They are ranked 31st by ESPN's College Football Power Index coming into the season, projected for 6.4 wins on average, which seems about right. I think going into their first season in the Big Ten with a lot of new faces, like 6 or 7 wins is the reasonable expectation.
Sure. That's fine. I'm not taking anything from any of this. Husky football wise, I think that is reasonable. I actually think
I just want people to come into this with reasonable expectations, because I know what it looks like when people have unreasonable expectations.
It
looks like Florida State.
There are a couple of different ways this could go. I think Jed Fish, I think Will Rogers could be better than we think. And I think Jed Fish could be a great coach. I also think there could be some of these Big Ten road trips that are a lot harder than we think. And there is a difference. I was talking about this with Katie earlier today. The Huskies have not fared well in the desert. The Huskies have not fared that well at altitude. And fortunately, neither of those things is going to happen. But we haven't seen that much of the Huskies traveling west to east to go and play a place like Iowa. You know, like, I just think there are some Big Ten road games that the atmosphere, everything about it is going to be a lot harder than we imagine. So I kind of view basically that like middle tier of the Big Ten, the Iowas, the Michigans, the Northwesterns, teams like that.
Michigan's
Rutgers,
the middle tier now?
Well, I don't know. Maybe Northwestern and Rutgers are kind of closer to the bottom, but like just every Big Ten road game is going to be hard, and it's all brand new for us.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I guess my other like big picture thought is our approach coming into the season should just be, hey, it's going to be fun to experience all these new things in the Big Ten. And the wins and losses are whatever.
I am not thinking that way.
I mean, you know Jed Fish's career record. Like, I think Jed Fish is a very good coach. This is funny. I know I didn't realize, didn't think about this until I was looking at the UW game notes today. His career record is below 500 because they went 1-11 his first season at Arizona.
I mean, he took over an extraordinarily bad
Obviously,
program.
like, yes, the Huskies are down relative to a team that was in the college football playoff game last year. They also were in the college football playoff game last year. The
Honestly, I
cupboard is
look
not
at this
empty.
roster across the board. I don't know if we're going to go through the depth chart, and I see a lot of experienced players. The line is the only thing that makes me nervous. Lines are important, but
That's like, I don't know what the roof of this house is the only thing that makes me nervous during this rainstorm. You're taking a wildly inexperienced line, to, and not necessarily like extremely talented on paper line to go play in the Big fucking Ten. I don't know if you're aware of this. They're known for having good offensive and defensive lines. That's a thing.
Yeah, I know. But I do think when you look, there are a lot of experienced players at skill positions. I think Jonah Coleman is going to be, I think we're going to love Jonah Coleman.
Oh, without question.
And Will Rogers has thrown more passes than anybody. No matter how far they've traveled down the field, Will Rogers has thrown a lot of passes. The receiving core, despite the fact that they're losing three wide receivers who are drafted, when you look at that receiving core, Jeremiah Hunter, Denzel Boston, Giles Jackson. It's a pretty solid receiving core. So there are pieces in place right now. Probably I think the team could be slightly better than people realize.
I mean, I hope so. Again, I just want to be pleasantly surprised.
But it's really right now, all we can do is take it one game at a time. We're just playing a game. They're just playing a game against Weber State. And if they win that game, that'll be, I assume they will, hope they will, but I'll tell you, we've been through worse.
We sure have.
So I don't want to take anything for granted. We have literally seen probably the worst loss in UW program history within the last 3 years.
In a season opening game against a team from the Big Sky Conference.
Yes.
You mentioned the experience at the top of the wide receiver depth chart, which I do feel very good about. Behind them, it's a little bit more of a question mark. Kevin Green Jr. is not expected to play until after the bye week, according to Jed Fish, after suffering an injury during the open scrimmage. And that means the three backup receivers on the depth chart are all freshmen. Redshirts Keith Reynolds and Rasheed Williams, and then true freshman Audric Harris, who looks like he'll be in the rotation from week one. There are four other true freshmen listed on the two deeps, some of which are, either or as backups. Those are obviously Damon Williams Jr. at quarterback, who sounds like it won't be terribly surprising if he plays outside of blowouts a little bit in some form or fashion early in the season. And then Pocky Finau at left guard, Decker DeGroff at tight end, and Kamori House at linebacker. Anything else you want to note about the depth chart? I guess the other notable, Javon Parker being listed as a starter on the defensive line was, I think, of a bit of surprise to the observers who follow the team. And then I think the most interesting thing to me was that Elijah Jackson was listed as an or starter with Ephesians Prysock, who seems to be clearly the number one corner for the Huskies, rather than with Thaddeus Dixon, who it had kind of been assumed he was competing for a starting job with. Although Thaddeus Dixon, I believe, is also listed as an or on the depth chart, and I do not
With
remember.
Darren Barkins, is that right?
That sounds plausible.
Okay. We'll see how this all plays out on the field.
I mean, I think we have a pretty good sense. It's probably going to be Thaddeus Dixon and Ephesians Prysock on that one.
Not Elijah Jackson.
I think Elijah Jackson will play a lot. Like, it's not, this is the thing. Other than maybe quarterback, like, who's first or second string isn't really
Everyone's
that
going to
important. Like,
play.
there's been so much talk about the fact that Carson Bruner has not been a starter. And it's like, okay, but he played a lot. He played like 40% of defensive snaps last season.
That's the other piece. It's one of those things of, again, going to the Big Ten. I'm much more concerned about the defensive line than I am the secondary. but that might be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think if you look at the strength of this team on both ends, it's probably the strength is farthest away from the football and the weakness is closest to, or the farthest away from the line of scrimmage. No, I guess the football
Maybe just like
and
one more year in the Pac-12.
the.
But
They don't even
you
play
look at the
Oregon State.
secondary between Prysock, Ephesians Prysock, just superstar. Chalk it up, done. Elijah Jackson, Cam Fabiculainen, Mikel Esteen, Thad Dixon,
Jordan
Jordan
Shaw
Scott,
and Nickelback.
and then Tuipulotu, Carson Bruner. Like the this is it is a more experienced secondary than people are giving them credit for right
I would agree
now.
with that, yeah.
And I think people are approaching this Husky team as like no one's coming back, which there are obviously a lot of very good players who are transfers in the NFL right now. There are still experienced players who played in these games, who played in the Pac-12 championship, who beat Oregon, who played in the college football playoff, who played in the national championship. They're
Or transferred
experienced
from
players.
somewhere else.
Or also, like Ephesians
They got a
Prysock was
lot of
playing
transfers.
in important games with Arizona. So I think, again, I don't view this as a complete starting over right now from what they'd built in the past. It's a transition for sure, but I don't think it's a complete starting over.
Yeah, I don't think it's a complete starting over. I think it's
I actually
definitely a
also don't think it looks that different than it would have had Kalen DeBoer been the head coach.
100%. Like some of the names are different. Yeah. And like,
I
I think
mean,
the offensive
maybe.
line we'd feel a lot different about. Parker Brailsford, Nate Kolepa, Julius Bulow would all be here rather than starting in the SEC. So you'd feel a
Yes.
lot better about the offensive line. That's the biggest difference. Is we've talked about Jabbar Muhammad versus Ephesians Prysock. That's something of a wash.
Upgrade.
I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far.
Okay, tell us about Weber State.
So it's the first ever meeting between these two teams
I was
in
gonna say
college
I don't
football.
recall like I don't recall seeing Weber State play anybody before.
I mean, obviously the Huskies for a very long period of time were one of the handful of Division I program FBS programs that had never played an FCS program. That changed, probably what about 15 years ago? I don't know.
Who
About
was the
when
first
Sark
one?
was hired
Eastern.
as coach. I would guess Eastern Portland State's the other strong candidate. Those are the two teams they've played most often from the Big Sky Conference. They've played Montana a fair bit. They obviously delivered the upset win when the Huskies lost their first ever game to an FCS opponent. The Weber State Wildcats went 6-5 last season, 4-4 in Big Sky in Mickey Mantle's first year as head coach. They
Okay.
finished the season strong with three consecutive wins, including beating number four Idaho, also a common UW foe, but back when they were in the FBS subdivision. That came after true freshman quarterback Richie Munoz took over for the final five games, throwing 10 touchdown passes in that span. Their former starter, Kylan Weiser, had just two in the seven games that he started. They are ranked number 22 in the Stats Perform FCS preseason poll, sixth in the Big Sky preseason poll. Four of the top eight seed teams in FCS coming into the season are in the Big Sky Conference. Weber State returns nine starters, a couple of notable ones besides Munoz. Defensive end Braden Wilson was an all Big Sky pick last year, while running back Damien Bankston was an honorable mention pick in 2022 before injury cut short his 2023 season after five games.
It's honestly so surprising to me that there are players who performed pretty well in the Big Sky Conference and didn't transfer.
Yes. This is fair. I think a lot of them tend to you get to that fifth year of eligibility or that, that if you can do a grad transfer year, that often is, I think, what happens.
I mean, or you just wait around until the offers are a little bit better, like play one more year at Weber State, beat up on some small teams. And if you're Richie Munoz, maybe go get a much better offer than you would have. Like, rather than having to transfer, again, we'll see how good Richie Munoz is, but rather than having to transfer to a small FBS team, then work your way up, it's like maybe he can just move to that team after next season.
Possibly so. So the Huskies are 27.5 favorites in this game. FPI gives them a 91% chance of victory.
Do we want to do a percentage chance of victory for the first time this year?
I mean, I suppose so.
I'm going to say 95%.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably about 95. That seems about right.
Let me give you another percentage chance.
What's that?
Percentage chance that UW is down or it's a little bit too close at the end of the first quarter and I start freaking out.
Was it an opening week last year that we freaked out a little bit? Like
Oh,
that
yes, it was.
they figured out Ryan Grubb's scheme. It's
In an
over.
undefeated season, we panicked in the first quarter of that season.
You remember when Pete Carroll was like toughing up to Seahawks
Yeah.
fans? Wait, was it?
It
Was
was UW versus Portland, I believe, right? Wasn't it
no?
Portland
They
last
opened
year?
last year on against Boise State, so maybe it was against Tulsa
Oh.
in week two that we were actually freaking out.
No, I think we freaked out against Boise State too.
Yeah, I guess they were up 14-3 after the first quarter against Tulsa, so it probably wasn't then. Maybe it was. Yeah, they were down 6-0 at the end of the first quarter against Boise State.
Win 56 to 19.
Subsequently scored 28 points in the
You know what's
second
so funny
quarter.
though? I was telling Luca because he was talking about that. I have zero recollection of this game.
It's only the vaguest recollection for me, I gotta be
I
honest.
think it was hot and all the children were there and I was kind of just paying attention to them. Oh, look at that. George Alani,
Yeah.
running back for Boise State.
Seahawks practice squatter.
It
Alexander
was safe.
Shipthright for 450 yards and five touchdowns.
Safe to say.
Dylan Morris threw a 31-yard touchdown on his only pass, although I may have been out of the stadium by that point.
I'm just saying, when you're down 6-0 in a game that you eventually win 56 to 19, like they were underperforming in the first quarter.
I look forward to after the
I
first
remember
quarter of the Seahawks
also
season
disliking
completing.
Dylan Johnson too. 7 carries for 12 yards. I
You
think he's
you
still a
were
little bit
very out on
hurt.
Dylan Johnson. I was like, let's all remain calm here.
Yeah, well, I did not remain calm. Thank you. And look, they'll have all these players who caught passes from last year. Roma Dunze, Jalen Polk, Jalen McMillan, Shaq Westover, Jeremy Bernard. I believe not as Quavas is gone also, right?
Yes, Cuevas is gone.
Is and Culp is gone?
He is gone. He, I think, exhausted his eligibility.
Not a single player who caught a pass in that game will be returning for the Huskies.
I mean, Giles Jackson caught many passes. They just happened not to be in that particular game.
He was hurt at the beginning of the year.
Devin Culp was drafted in the 7th round. Did he make the Buccaneers roster?
Oh yeah, we got drafted by the Bucks. I forgot about that.
Yeah, he is on their 53 man. Shouts
There
to
we
Devin
go.
Culp. Well, should that naturally transition us to talking about the Seahawks cutdown day?
It does. Yeah, so they are returning 14 catches for Giles Jackson, 5 for Denzel Boston, 2 for Rasheed Williams,
I mean,
2
Jeremiah
for Wood
Hunter did
Wolf.
have a lot of fucking catches for Cal.
Man, I remember Denzel Boston having way more than 5 catches.
I don't know that I remember that. Jeremiah Hunter had 62 catches last season.
Everybody starts somewhere.
So it was a busy week of transactions for the Seahawks ahead of the cutdown to 53 players, starting with their trade of Edge J.R. Taylor to the Bears for a 2025 6th-round pick. Taylor was on a 1-year non-guaranteed $3.1 million deal signed as a restricted free agent. He had 21.5 sacks in 3 seasons with the Seahawks, peaking at 9.5 in 2022 before dropping to 5.5 last season, and represented as a second-round pick, the final member of the 2021-20? What year was that? 2020 draft class who was with the Seahawks.
I'm just noting about Roma Dunze. We expected basically nothing of him going into a sophomore year. He wasn't somebody who was on, and not everybody's going to turn to Roma Dunze, but he was at he had 41 catches for 400 yards in 2021, and then exploded to like 15 yards per reception in 2022 and over 1,000 yards. So, shit can change.
It is certainly true.
Gerald Taylor, though.
You know, many derided the Pelton cast for its negativity on the 2020 draft recap with Zach Wittman as third Pelton brother. And there were certainly some moments for that group, but it is, and like some of them did get paid. Jordan Brooks got paid this year. Damian Lewis got paid, but it is fascinating that none of them are still Seattle Seahawks 4 years later.
Fascinating.
That's not the word you would choose.
It's fascinating.
The Seahawks may have thought they were all set at edge before Chinua Nwosu suffered an MCL sprain on an illegal chop block on Saturday, an injury that typically carries a timeline of 2 to 6 weeks. Good news, Seahawks did not place him on IR, and John Schneider said he doesn't anticipate needing to do so, meaning Nwosu expected to return within the first 4 weeks. But his availability for week one certainly in question. And just before that was announced on Monday, the Seahawks then sent their own 6th round pick to the Jaguars for edge Travis Gibson, also a 2020 draft pick of the Chicago Bears in the 5th round. So Gibson, 11 career sacks. He had 7 in 2021 for the Bears, just 4 since then, as he's not been quite as productive, but we'll see if the Seahawks can get more out of him than took place over those last few years.
And certainly adding some depth. I mean, there's some other players who are going to have to step up in this position. I think the most frustrating part is that Chinua Nwosu, after coming off
Right,
injury,
just getting healthy.
getting re-injured again, it'll affect the team on the field, but it's kind of just brutal for a Chinua Nwosu too, that to have this happen, have it happen on an illegal block in a preseason game. I mean, it's just.
I mean, it definitely wasn't something like a planned situation. It was just like he was getting past the block he was on, and the running back came over. And I can't remember exactly who went high and who went low, but that's the situation where it is. There are certain situations in which chop blocks are legal. That was an illegal one that was flagged, and
I mean,
that
it's
was why it's a dangerous play.
football and it's a dangerous sport overall. And I'm not sure if I see the value in having played starters. It literally any player being injured is worse than whatever rust might happen by playing in the first regular season game without having played a preseason game. It's not worth it.
Your position remains noted. The head
But
coach of the last two Super Bowl champions disagrees. The other
who,
Seahawks
Andy
trade,
Reid?
yeah. They
Okay.
play their starters, don't they? I don't know if they still do. They definitely have. The Seahawks also traded
They
cornerback
have
Michael Jackson.
Patrick Mahomes.
Well, yeah. That's all the reason. More reason not play your starters in the
I
preseason.
mean, I
Chinua
agree.
Nwosu getting injured is not, with all due respect, as big a deal as Patrick Mahomes. I think
The
Chinua Nwosu would
Seahawks
acknowledge that.
need players like Uchenna Nwosu more than the Chiefs do.
I suppose so.
And I mean, quarterbacks are much less likely to get injured in a preseason game than somebody like Nwosu.
I suppose. Seahawks traded cornerback Michael Jackson to Carolina in exchange for linebacker Michael Barrett, a rare challenge trade of Michael's. Barrett was a rookie 7th round pick out of Michigan who played under Mike McDonald during his year as Wolverines defensive coordinator. Subsequently, did not make the final roster after playing in the preseason finale, is part of the practice squad. So, this mostly seems to be a case where the Seahawks knew they were going to cut Jackson and they did him a solid and got something out of it. Jackson set to start in Carolina under former Seahawks coach Dave Canales.
There you go. I mean, good for Mike Jack. There's a reality that under Mike McDonald, the roster is going to look very different by this time next year. There was less time for it to transform this offseason, but coaches want to find their guys overall.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to be like a Pete Carroll 2010 style thing. Speaking of
I
which,
mean, that roster needed to be torn down, and this roster doesn't, but.
I
Speaking of
mean,
Pete Carroll.
we are seeing to a degree that makeover because I just said the 2020 draft class is all gone.
Yes.
And the 2021 draft class, we'll talk about one of those guys in a second. There were only three in the first place. Two of them are left. One of them's pretty deep on the depth chart. So. I don't even remember who the other one is. Because it's Stone Forsythe, D. Eskridge. I can't even remember. Oh, There was a lineman in there, right? No, Stone Forsythe is a lineman. I don't know. I'll look it up. You're not getting those are like the drafts that should be making up the heart of your roster is 2020 and 2021. And the Seahawks are currently getting nothing from
I mean, I
those.
think it's been pretty well documented how bleak those couple of seasons were for the Seahawks, both on the field and off the
Oh,
field.
Trey Brown is the third player from that group, so he is playing an important role.
They're still making up for it. They're still making up for decisions that were made during that time period, both draft-wise, trade-wise, on the field playing time-wise. They're undoing. The last couple of years have been undoing those years, more or less, and building it back up.
The Athletic had a feature on Dave Canales on Wednesday, and it was interesting. It was an interesting piece, but I thought something that stuck out about the Seahawks was the line of he said that he, I don't know if he directly was quoted as saying this or was just referenced. Oh, yeah, it wasn't directly quoted. A process that the group wasn't broken, he decided, even after 2-15. He wouldn't have to rebuild the culture, a process that took Carroll 3 long years in Seattle. Which is kind of strange to say about a team that made the playoffs this first season. Granted, it was at 7-9, but like the culture, the vibes seemed pretty awesome in 2010. And
Describing
certain.
it as 3 long years is the exact wrong way to describe it. And I don't know who wrote this, but it's just wrong.
I mean,
He
I, but I,
made the playoffs, went 7-9 in a year that by the second half of the season, the vibes were immaculate,
yeah, like
and
the
then
pieces
made the
were all in
playoffs.
place. I mean,
It
again,
took Pete
I'm.
Carroll, in fact, 0 long years to rebuild the Seahawks.
I mean, it took about 3 years, I think, to rebuild the roster to the point where it was good enough. But to
What does
rebuild the
3 years
culture.
mean, though? Because by the third season, they were the best team in the league.
Yeah.
Pete Carroll rebuilt that team in one off season. Pete Carroll
You.
and John Schneider rebuilt the team in one off season.
I
They
wouldn't
made the
agree with that.
playoffs. They made the playoffs. I mean, they had a couple of pieces in place for
I
that
mean,
because
they were
they
like
drafted
28th in
Okung.
DVOA in 2011.
Had they dra they drafted Okung and
Or
Earl
2010, I
Thomas
should say.
that year, right? That was their rookie year that they made the playoffs, the 7-9
Yes.
year. I guess they're back-to-back 7-9 years. But it had started that season, and then they completely flipped it over the next year. And by the end of that season, that was kind of the roster that, and then added Ross. But
Yeah,
like,
there was one very important piece.
I don't think that is an accurate way to describe what happened. If Dave Canales could have a first season that compared to Pete Carroll's first season, they would be very lucky to have that.
I agree. 100%. But that was a side note. Getting back to let's talk about health. Abe Lucas will start the season on the PUP list. John Schneider said they're, quote, playing the long game with Lucas, but he does think he'll play at some point this season when he was asked that directly.
This is brutal.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the single biggest. If you're looking at, like, what's going to undo, because as down as you are in playing the starters, like seeing Geno Smith come out and hit four consecutive passes and march the ball down the field and DK Metcalf score a touchdown, that was fun. Football is fun. But if there's something that can undo the optimism about the Seahawks that I am feeling right now, it is Abe Lucas's health and the status of the offensive line more generally. Besides Nwosu, Schneider said center Connor Williams and safety Rashawn Jenkins question marks for week one due to their injuries. And that may be reflected a little bit in some of the moves in the cutdown. Their
If
notable
only they
cuts.
had Nick Harris right now.
Artie Burns, who was re-signed to the practice squad. And then Adam Schefter reported he was in line for a week one promotion to the active roster. But then Schneider said he aggravated the toe injury he suffered Saturday in practice on Wednesday. So we'll see what happens there. But, you know, Artie Burns clearly going to be part of this team going forward. Probably mostly a situation where vested veterans have their salary guaranteed if they're on the 53-man roster for week one and players on the practice squad don't. So. Love that sweet, sweet team control as usual. Dee Eskridge is a reference earlier and then signed with the Dolphins practice squad rather than continuing his career in Seattle. Actually had a very nice game on Saturday in his final appearance as a Seahawk. For now, we'll see if there's another reunion in the cards down the road. George Helani, who we've talked about earlier and is on the practice squad. And then DJ James, the cornerback they drafted in the sixth round, the only draft pick not to make the roster. He is not as yet on the practice squad. Don't know what's going to happen with him. They kept 11 offensive linemen, including three rookies, their
He went to
draft
Oregon,
picks.
right? Yep.
Oh, before he went to Auburn?
Yeah, good riddance.
Draft. Look, we've had plenty of fine Oregon players.
He
I will,
did
you will not.
intentionally leave Oregon to go somewhere else,
You
so.
will do not besmirch the good name of Maurice Morris on this podcast. Draft picks Michael Jarrell and Sataoa Laomea, plus undrafted free agent Jalen Sundell, made the roster as rookies at offensive line. Sundell appearing perhaps insurance for Connor Williams at center. Return specialist D. Williams made it. Most of the roster projections I saw for the Seahawks didn't have him at the end, but I kind of had a hunch he was going to make it. He was so important, especially with kickoff returns being emphasized this season.
No, and it makes sense all of a sudden to carry a return specialist on the roster where maybe a year ago it didn't.
Yeah. And then the Panthers, in addition to trading for Mike Jack, also claimed a pair of Seahawks off waivers. Veteran linebacker John Rattigan, who is likewise playing on a $3 million restricted free agent tenor, and undrafted free agent Edge Jamie Sheriff, who flashed with multiple sacks in the preseason. So that was interesting because he was not someone who came in with a lot of pedigree, but played quite well in the preseason and did end up earning a 53-man roster spot with the Panthers out of it. So there we go. The Seahawks are off this weekend. I have not yet contacted Ben Baldwin, but hopefully we will have him back as third Pelton brother next week to do our annual season
Wow, we've
preview.
got to do over. Man, we've got shit to do.
We do have shit to do.
That's like a Labor Day tradition, is doing
I don't know if we're gonna
over-unders for the season.
do
I've
it
thought,
on Labor Day.
honestly, so little about the NFL overall, though. But looking at fantasy stuff, I was like, it kind of brought it back. I'm excited. It's funny, like the rhythm of it all, where like I watched no preseason, really. Like I watched half watched the Seahawks. I watched not a single second of any other preseason games. And I feel like that's a little bit different in the past. Maybe it's just because of how people treat preseason or whatever, but the different beats of it. And then we're just going to go into it in 2 weeks and I'll watch every single NFL game that I possibly can.
Well, you'll have two games to
And
watch next
you
week.
tell me you don't like the fall.
I'd rather sit outside. I'd rather be
You'd
able
rather
to.
sit outside than watch football?
I would.
Wow. We are not the same.
We are not.
I've sat outside before.
You've had it overrated.
It's fine. Football is only overrated sometimes.
Yeah, searching for Seattle's best places to sit outside.
Oh, there are a lot of great places to sit outside, not gonna lie.
Oh, someone's
Yeah.
coming around on sitting outside. Well,
Are
Husky
you gonna come
Stadium.
around on football though?
I mean, I don't dislike football. I'm just saying. Also, it's my off season. That's also part of why I like the summer, Not that I don't like my job and I don't like basketball. It's
Some of
just
us don't
the off
get
season is
off
fun.
seasons.
Well, congrats on your multiple Rolling Stone features.
Rise and grind, baby.
Well, on that note,
Thanks for listening.
thanks.
Are we going to talk fantasy football at all?
Possibly. We do still have drafts remaining, so I don't want to get too specific.
Okay. We know, I don't, it's not further players. It's mostly just like, did you have a strategy going in, or what did you? What is your, how do
Are
you
you going to
make
see?
your own projections?
I mean, you take player performance over the past 3 seasons and adjust it for age and team context. It's very simple. This literally is my job.
The way that you treat this as if it's like, I merely take player performance over the last 3 seasons and adjust for age. How do you factor in like rookies and stuff like that though?
Based strictly on team context, which may or may not be a good way to do it. And then I'm just scraping the usage rates entirely.
And then how do you weigh basically positional value, or do you just...
So there's a replacement level for each position based on, at one point I calculated like what the typical score is for players off the waiver wire each week, or like who the best waiver pickup is at each position each week. And that's what I use, and is context. And it works pretty well for PPR. At half point PPR, it really, the quarterback values got all messed up, but running backs and wide receivers and tight ends seemed reasonably all right.
Can I say that this is just like so much work to have just like drafted Christian Kirk? You know what I mean? Like, you put in so much effort. Like,
You make it to like a drifted Christian Kirk in the second round or something.
but you understand what I'm saying,
He's
right?
like my number three wide receiver, and hopefully not that, because hopefully my upside wide receivers will surpass him. But yes.
I guess I'm not even mad. I'm just impressed. So for my strategy, I did a mock draft.
I also, for the first time ever, did a mock draft because I wanted to see what was going to happen with the half point PPR thing. And the mock draft, I like the way it turned out a lot better than the real one.
You like the mock draft? I tried to do 12 team. You did the same thing, 12 team half point PPR mock draft. So teams just draft very differently. Like, the people that we draft with are smarter than the mock draft people.
I agree. I mean, it wasn't
And also, a lot
necessarily,
of
it would
people are
also.
on like auto draft and mock drafts.
A lot of it is that, oh no, I mean, it was all auto draft, wasn't it? You were
On mock
drafting
draft.
like live with other people?
Yeah.
Oh no, I just did a simulated draft where everyone else was on auto draft.
Oh, I went into a mock draft lobby.
But the other thing is getting the number one pick, as much as everyone is going to call it
Oh no,
rigged.
that's what I'm saying. I hate the number one pick. I think it's an insult. Not an insult. I think it is one of the worst picks to have.
I mean, so the upside is, if Christian McCaffrey is really good, and like my projections say he's substantially more valuable than anyone else, like, yeah, then I'm gonna be have a good team. It's interesting, the Ringer does not have him number one. They have him like fourth overall,
They
even in
love
half point
Breece
PPR.
Hall. I was like,
Let me tell you, my metrics do not love, my projections do not love Breece Hall, because they've looked at the Jets offense in past seasons. Now there's no quarterback adjustment, is the big thing
yeah,
I'm
see, that's what I'm
missing.
saying.
So
I'm a
like, if
little
Aaron
skeptical
Rodgers is
about
good.
just.
But also, it's the Jets. Y'all, we just went through this last year. Y'all fell for it one time.
I think if I had drafted Breece Hall with the first pick in the draft, I don't think I could feel good about myself.
I would not feel comfortable with it. It is way too big a
But there's
risk,
also,
because
do
there's
you remember
this.
last year, like, people were losing their shit about Tony Pollard, right?
They
Tony
were.
Pollard, Austin Eckler. And now those players are like sixth, seventh round players, which also kind of goes to show just how little value individual running backs have. Because it's pretty, like, there are basically no running backs that, outs context aside, are going to be high fantasy draft picks. Whereas receivers are all kind of, they're generally the same,
I
you
mean, it's
know?
also just like how quickly people move on to the next hot thing.
I think
Because it's
that's
not like
part of
people.
it. But also, like, their situations are different. Tony Pollard's situation is way different. Austin Eckler's situation is way different.
It's not like people are like, hey, I'm super excited about Ezekiel Elliott because he's now the Cowboys' starting running back.
But running backs also. Honestly, it's kind of more of an indictment on running backs in general. But with Christian McCaffrey, your whole draft is so entirely based on the success of Christian McCaffrey.
So I looked back at this, and the last time, because of the allegations in the chat, I looked back on this. The last time that I had the number one pick was 2019.
Okay.
I have not had a pick higher than seventh in any either of our leagues since 2020.
Who is.
And remember, I'm drafting in two leagues each year.
I like how seriously you took this. People are just
Oh,
joking.
look, I have been known to respond too seriously to jokes. In 2019, I took Saquon Barkley number one, and it was a year where he'd like missed three games and was just kind of very mid,
Just fine. Yeah.
aggressively fine. I had the second pick in the other league that year and took Christian McCaffrey, and it probably worked out well. I don't remember specifically. You did have an
I
interesting
just.
question about like which players you've had on your team the most. I do kind of want to scrape the ESPN data and come up with that, but I'm pretty sure the answer is Keenan Allen, and
It
or
has to be Keenan Allen.
Mike Evans is way up there.
You do like Mike Evans. Do you have either of them this year?
I have neither. I mean, Keenan Allen, I'm like, now is like a stay away for me.
Because you know that all those targets are going to Rome, baby.
Of course. I definitely drafted Rome in the mock draft I did, and Jalen Polk.
So my basic thinking was, after doing the mock draft, there are a ton of wide receivers that I like further down in the draft, and there are basically no running backs that I like after the very top.
See, I felt when it actually played out in practice, I did not feel that way. Like, there was a ton of running backs that, like, yeah, I could start him and it'd be fine.
They're doing the actual draft. That was my strategy going in. I was like, basically, no matter what, I'm going running back, first two picks. And then that honestly was kind of just to, like, let myself off the hook so that I can just take a million wide receivers after that, where I'm like, cool, check, done. You know, I've got these positions handled. But there aren't even, like, a lot of great flyer running backs, I feel like.
I have just a list of five flyer running backs. Drafted two of them. You drafted one of them. One of them I don't think got drafted at all, intriguingly, but maybe misremembering on that one.
That was kind of like, there's so many teams that basically have running backs by committee or close to it.
Right.
That it's, there are players who are hypothetically starting running backs. I mean, even the Ezekiel Elliott being one of them, until, I guess, I don't know about Dalvin Cook or whatever, but, like, he is the starting running back for what is probably going to be a very good offense, but you just know so many people are going to get carries, and he doesn't, you know, he's not going to get a ton of receptions in the half point PPR. And it's kind of like, he'd be fine.
Yeah.
As your second running back.
So the other thing about the picking first, which I think is what you're complaining about, is that, like, if you want a specific player, you have to either, like, hope they're still going to be there when you pick, or maybe reach for them like 10 picks before they should go.
Yes.
Which ended up happening to me with one of my picks that I think was roundly mocked. So I don't want to get too far into it, because we still have another draft to go.
Who was it?
And it involves the people who listen to this podcast.
Roundly
so,
mocked.
Roundly mocked. But, like, that player was on my list. There wasn't anybody else I loved. So it was like, eh, well, I guess I'm going to do it.
You put in all these projections and it just spit out Christian Kirk.
Season, didn't he?
I feel comfortable making fun of, just using that as an example, because you're so concerned about people, like, snaking your picks. The thing about, if somebody, like, takes one of your picks, there's other, it's all, like, in context with other players.
I mean,
does that make sense?
Really talking about the first three or four, but again, the context was, there wasn't anybody else I liked at that pick.
The other thing that I felt like,
there wasn't
was
anybody
that,
I thought was better.
Kind of interestingly, there are almost no, like, even Sam Laporta, there are almost no tight ends where I'm like, yeah, that tight end is it. I kind of feel like 1 to 12, the tight ends, any of them could be the number one tight end this year.
I don't wish to comment on the tight end position at this time.
Wow.
Yeah.
I ended up not getting Dalton Kincaid. I was like, can I at least get an X Pac-12 running or tight end? But there were a lot of flyer players that I wanted. Wow, the amount of rookie wide receivers I drafted is staggering. But there were a lot of flyer wide receivers. Whereas, like, I love all these, I like all these starting wide receivers who are in the, like, third, fourth, fifth rounds. I like all these flyer wide receivers. And I don't really care for almost any of the running backs after the first two rounds. So that was kind of my only strategy.
Okay.
I ended up drafting a quarterback much higher than I thought I would. It was basically like Richardson was there, and I was like, it's a boomer bust pick, but there's a chance that Anthony Richardson is the number one overall fantasy point getter.
Given that you drafted Anthony Richardson, I'm surprised that you did not go for a backup quarterback higher.
I kept trying to, but the players that I wanted ended up being drafted.
Somebody took a backup quarterback right before I wanted to draft them.
There were like three or four times that I was going to draft a backup quarterback, and then somebody was taken, and I was like, all right, well, guess we're going rookie wide receiver again. you can always go back to the rookie wide receiver. Well,
there's always room at the rookie wide receiver inn. Oh, you did take both Rome and Polk. I love it. I was, One of your players I was considering, your rookie wide receivers, I was strongly considering drafting, but he had the wrong bye week, so I just couldn't do it.
Is it the other one of those rookie wide
I
receivers?
mean, there's only three of them.
I had him circled as like this is the one player I want to get out of this draft.
Interesting. I did not have that particular receiver that high, but was interested in taking him.
I mean, there's not a lot of other players there.
Actually, there are dozens of other players.
But on
They're
there are
just
certain
mostly, you're
players
just saying that they're mostly Demario Douglas.
I went and looked through like the depth chart of every team, and there were some things where I was like, huh, like Texans wide receivers, where they're just three. I mean, somebody's gonna get hurt along the way. And I did draft Tank Dell, but it kind of was a little bit of like, I think these targets might get spread around a little bit with the Texans. And the Bears too, honestly. Like I feel like the Bears were a bit of a stay away. To me, I think the most likely outcome for Rome, even though I drafted him, is probably a JSN type season. Where he's just never going to be good enough to start. He'll like make some great plays, but you never know. I don't know. Like that, he could end up being amazing. Like I think Rome Odunze is probably a better receiver than JSN is. So, but it's just kind of crowded between when you look at it. It's like
I mean, I guess
Keenan,
he
DJ
is. He
Moore.
did go like, what, 18, 15 picks higher?
I mean, not that that exactly matters, but.
It's certainly an indicator.
I think just after watching them, Roman Dunsay is just really good. I mean, I also really wanted Malik Nabers too and ended up not getting him.
I think Malik Nabers went very high. I guess
He
he
did.
was 11 picks higher.
But yeah, no, I wanted a backup quarterback. Wait, who did you draft at quarterback? Are you not at liberty to share?
I think
People can
that's
just go
some.
look at the team.
They can, but that's gonna be a lot of work for them to do, as opposed to listening to the end of this podcast. It's also someone else who is probably very high on my. I've had this player so many years, including the year he got injured in the first game.
Trader Mina. Oh yeah, I didn't like that pick at all.
You don't have my projections.
I can't remember which pick you made that was mocked.
I hope you continue not to remember that.
Was it a tight end?
I hope you continue not to remember that. All right.
There a lot of your like flyer running backs I also had on my list.
The other thing I'll say is, so last year I won the Champions League. And did better in that than the other league, which is kind of funny because I do think the Champions League
You're just
is
casually dropping that
competing a little harder. And I think the
as you
reason
be
is last year the Champions League
driving
draft
the
was
champions.
second. And I think there is a big advantage to us, the fact that we've already gone through a whole draft. I mean, it'll be a little different this year because the
Do you
half
think we're
point
the only
PPR.
two people who have done a fantasy draft? I think many people.
I'm just saying, like, with this group of people, like, because not everyone has the same tastes, I guess. I mean, you're probably
I
playing
do
with
think that
Seahawks and
the
Husky fans,
average
but
Pelton Cast listener probably drafts pretty similarly to the way that we do.
right. All right.
There are just certain players where I'm like, yeah, Joe Mixon, I'm good.
I would have taken Joe Mixon at a certain point. I wouldn't have felt great, good about it though.
There's like the combination of people who there's like personal stuff, and just performance, and you're just like, you know what, I'm good.
And Joe Mixon went literally the pick ahead of me, so I was not upset about that necessarily.